Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment with the design flaws and deficiencies of the 40-year-old General Electric boiling water reactor Mark I, four out of six of which are in various stages of meltdown and distress at the Fukushima plant in Japan. Linda Gunter with the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear joins us to discuss whether the final line of defense, the containment systems, will fail on these substandard designed old reactors that were months away from retirement. Then we'll examine rising tensions in the Gulf following the entry of Saudi troops into Bahrain that has been met by condemnation from Iran. Rasul Nafisi, an Iranian-American analyst of Middle East affairs, joins us to discuss an emerging surrogate war between Saudi Arabia and Iran that could turn Bahrain, the home of the Navy's Fifth Fleet, into another Beirut. Then finally, we'll look further into a possible showdown in the Gulf with Yusuf Ibrahim, who was the New York Times senior regional Middle East correspondent for 18 years. He has spent a lot of time recently in the Gulf and feels that the Saudi regime's clumsy overreaction to demonstrations in Bahrain, inspired by the Egyptian revolution, will play right into the hands of the Iranian regime and hasten the end of the corrupt ruling Al Saud family's absolute monarchy in oil-rich Arabia. Joining me now is Linda Gunter, who founded the organization Beyond Nuclear, an organization that aims to educate and activate the public about the connections between nuclear power and nuclear weapons and the need to abandon both to safeguard our future. She currently serves as Beyond Nuclear's international specialist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Linda Gunter.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
And I guess your husband who works with you is quoted in the Washington Post today talking about these old reactors, that 31 of which we have here in the United States, and as I mentioned a minute ago, four out of the six in Fukushima, Japan, are in various stages of distress and meltdown. It's extraordinary to think that they were what, months away from being decommissioned, these reactors?
I believe one of them was actually just recently relicensed, but I'm not completely up to speed on that. But either way, obviously, this design is deeply flawed and very vulnerable, and there should not be any boiling water reactor Mark I's operating anywhere.
And what do you consider the greatest deficiency?
Well, they are a design that they're quite small, and they are very vulnerable to degradation, being bombarded with radiation heat all these years, and therefore they're more likely to corrode. What we've seen, for example, at the Oyster Creek reactor, which is the oldest reactor in this country and the smallest, and is a boiling water Mark I reactor, exactly like the Fukushima ones, is corrosion of the containment in multiple places. So they're vulnerable to collapse, basically, and therefore too dangerous, really, to risk. The other problem that we're seeing actually very visually, unfortunately, in Japan, is that the fuel pools, what they call the irradiated fuel pools, after the fuel's been used in the reactor, are stored in this design outside of the containment, pretty much on the roof, on the upper level of the reactor, outside containment, with really no solid barrier around them. And what we suspect, or more than suspect, is happening at the Unit 4, where there have been now two fires, is that that's a spent fuel pool fire. So those are the issues that concern us about the vulnerability of these reactors, which was actually recognized in 1972 when they first came online in this country. The then Atomic Energy Commission declared them too dangerous and that they would not license any more of this design. Now, why they were not closed then is anybody's guess. In 1985, the Safety Commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said that the containment had a 90% chance of failure in the event of the accident. They still didn't shut them, and we still got 23 Mark I's today, and they're getting license extensions.
So after the first ruling on the first one, they managed to, I thought there were a total of 31, but you're saying there's only 23 here in the United States.
Well, there are 23 of the Mark I design. There are an additional 8 boiling water reactors that are of a Mark II design, which is the same as those in Japan. So since we're making the comparison with Japan, strictly speaking, but either way, I mean, the boiling water reactor is definitely of concern either way.
And the biggest design flaw that I understand, though, is that because they're light, they're a kind of a scaled-down version of the main pressurized water technology that was produced by the rivals Westinghouse and Areva. And their containment is very, very limited, isn't it?
Yes, and I think also the other flaw is that when they first designed them, they did not have the capacity. They did actually retrofit them after the AEC said in 72, too dangerous. They retrofitted them with the pipe that allows them to vent, if pressure builds up. And that's exactly what we've seen going on in Japan, that the only way to save the reactor is to vent the radioactivity into the air.
And they didn't put any filters on it, though, as they do in Europe.
Sorry?
They didn't put any filters on that venting as they do in Europe.
I don't know. But, either way, I mean, when you vent radioactivity into the atmosphere, that's an exposure risk for the surrounding populations. And if you have to do it deliberately in order to save the reactor, you're making a sacrifice of the surrounding populations on purpose in order not to have a worse event, which would be a meltdown. So, I mean, talk about the lesser of two evils. It's one evil or another. It's just a question of degree.
Well, again, Linda Gunter, I'm astounded at what is happening there at that site. And a lot of it may be explained by the fact that it is so radioactive that there's a reduced level of manpower. And that, of course, in itself raises some very scary possibilities. But the fact that nobody appeared to notice that the swimming pool on the roof of Reactor 4 was the water level was sufficiently low to create fires in these spent fuel rods. And it's worth noting that these fuel rods are impregnated with really dangerous radioactive nuclei. So when they burn, their fallout is incredibly dangerous. And you say there are two fires that have happened so far. And the other thing that's extraordinary is that the reactor 2, which is the one that's most exposed, the core of which is most exposed, they lost their water level because an engine-powered pump ran out of fuel.
Right. I mean, obviously, this all started with a loss of electricity. You lose power to one of these things, you're in trouble. You're relying on backup diesel generators. Then they go out. You're relying on batteries. Then they go out. They're in big trouble there. And you mentioned the workforce. What I've been hearing, it sounds like you're very on top of things, but what I've been hearing, and I've been running around all day, so I apologize, I'm not completely current, is that there are only 50 people left inside now trying to cope with this possibly cascading problem from one facility to the next, and that those 50 people almost certainly are sacrificial lambs to, that they will not survive this, not necessarily tomorrow, but in the fairly near term, because of the dose levels that they must be getting. So it's a tragic, awful situation. The only cure is prevention. the possibility of this, if there's any possibility that you could have an outcome like this, then the risk is too great.
I spoke yesterday with a specialist on the environmental and security implications of nuclear technology, and he was lamenting how dangerous these reactors are in terms of targets for terrorism, because all you'd have to do is punch a hole in these thin concrete walls in these swimming pools containing the spent rods, and they'll immediately start flaring up. It takes them years to cool down, and then the fire will, of course, contains all this hideous radioactive poison. The other point he made was that, look how nature disabled these backup systems. And apparently, from what I'm learning from you, Linda, is that this particular GE design of the boiling water reactor really does require constant circulation of water, which means that if you lose power, the backups have to come in. And And it seems to be so easy to knock out these redundant backup systems.
Yes, well, there are so many vulnerabilities. I mean, obviously, all reactors are vulnerable to sabotage or attack, but the boiling water reactors, particularly because of the vulnerability of the fuel pool, as you described, I mean, that's been a concern. We labeled these. We've been calling for these, along with Dan Hirsch, who I imagine is who you were referring to. You know, we've been calling for these to be closed down for a very, very long time, for security reasons as well as safety reasons, because you could hit it with a twin-engine Cessna. You know, you don't need a jumbo jet to cause some serious damage at one of these, and we refer to them as a dirty bomb in your backyard. And I would not want to live close by to one of these plants, that's for sure. So there's so many problems with this design. But that said, you know, you can look at Diablo Canyon, sitting on a cliff edge on top of the San Andreas Fault Line near San Luis Obispo. I mean, that's an insane situation as well. It's a different design. We're not talking about the BWR here, but you know, look where they built the thing. So you've got San Onofre further down near San Diego on a surfer beach, you know, sitting target for tsunami. So we've taken gambles. We've taken 104 gambles in this country. That's how many operating reactors we have right now, with people's lives, unnecessarily so, considering the alternatives.
So let's go over some of what you just told us, Linda Gunter, though, because it's fairly disturbing when it comes from, I take it in the first case we're talking about Harold Denton, the director of the NRC's Office of Nuclear Reactor Regulation.
Yeah.
And he said that the Mark One, the boiling water Mark One we're talking about, containment you'll find it something like 90% probability of that containment failing. So these are the designs we're talking about.
Yeah.
So the information so far has been painstakingly sort of the bad news, I guess, has been coming out in dribs and drabs. It does feel like a compounding and cascading out of control situation. Have you noticed a difference between what is apparently going on and the kind of happy talk in the mainstream corporate press about this whole hideous unfolding catastrophe?
It's incredible to watch, actually, that how you can sit and look at the kinds of pictures that we're looking at and see the information that we're getting and still go into this complete denial. But I think that what you're looking at is, you know, the corporate control that this industry has, which is, you know, huge amounts of lobbying dollars for one thing, and you know, they're desperate. This is their ultimate nightmare. I mean, it's obviously an ultimate nightmare for the Japanese people, first and foremost. But for the nuclear industry, this is what they dreaded. This is what could finish them off. So they have to go out there and spin it that it's no big deal, that radiation doesn't harm you, or that it's only low levels, or that they've got it under control, and so forth. You know, until the evidence is incontrovertible, which I think it's pretty much there. I mean, people keep saying, well, what's the worst, you know, what, talk about the worst case scenario, the meltdown. But I don't know that we need to get to that. I mean, we've got a hideously tragic situation. You know, there's this scale that they're using. They're calling it a 6 out of 7 now, so it's between 3 Mile Island and Chernobyl. I mean, does this matter? It's absolutely dire for Japan and probably eventually for the rest of the world. And it ought to finish off this industry. But obviously, the Japanese government, TEPCO, and the industry here, and the folks in Congress whose pockets they line, that they are going to hold on to that tune as long as they can.
Well, in the Washington Post article that quotes your husband, it also mentions a nuclear physicist, Ken Bergeron, I guess, at Sandia, who has done an analysis of General Electric's boiling water Mark One, and he said the containment system was designed to withstand discrete problems known as design basis accidents, such as broken pipes and releasing hot steam. No, the containment system wasn't designed for what's happening in Japan.
I'm sure he's right. Yeah, I saw him earlier on MSNBC, actually, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's why I find it so incredible that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is willing to sacrifice public safety to protect industry profit. Because obviously something could have been done, but if it costs the industry money, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will make sure that there's an alternative for them. And the fact that they relicensed one of these, the Vermont Yankee plant is a boiling water reactor. The state of Vermont voted to shut it down on time when its license expires in March 2012. The governor, Pete Shumlin, wants it shut down in March 2012. And the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission relicensed it last week. Now, an interesting question would be, if they hadn't got it done last week and they were about to relicense it this week, would they have done it? Who knows? But I really feel that the assumption that a reactor like that, which has had a fire, has had a cooling tower collapse and numerous leaks of tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, into groundwater, can be relicensed for another 20 years is an outrage.
And it remains to be seen whether this accident will have any effect on the NRC having some second thoughts. I mean, the bottom line here, I think, for our audience is that just to begin with, this 40-year-old General Electric designed boiling water Mark I reactor was considered pretty flawed from the beginning. It's a kind of it was designed on the cheap, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it was designed on the cheap. You know, we can do these cheap. We can turn them out quickly. You know, that was the motivation to bring them online. It was recognized, as you said, early on, 40 years ago almost, that they were too dangerous. They're still here, and they're relicensing them. You know, there are a lot of questions, I think, about the regulator, just as there were after the BP catastrophe with MMS, you know. How cozy are they with the industry? I mean, the NRC is funded by the nuclear industry primarily, so it's compromised immediately by that. And it's accountable to Congress, but Congress never invites them in to explain themselves, and that's another thing we've been pushing for, is a proper investigation of whether the NRC is really doing its job and putting public safety first. And in our view, that's not the case right now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Linda Gunter.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Linda Gunter, who is the founder of Beyond Nuclear, and she follows the international nuclear issues for Beyond Nuclear. You may learn more about her work at beyondnuclear.org. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about rising tensions in the Gulf. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Rasul Nafisi, who's an academic and Middle East expert. His latest book is The Rise of the Pasdaran, a monograph on the social, political, and economic roles of the Guardians of the Revolution in Iran. And he will soon publish another book called The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest, and is quoted in today's New York Times suggesting Bahrain may become a battleground between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rasul Nafis.
Thank you, sir.
And the full quote in the New York Times is that you say that now that the Saudis have gone in, they may spur a similar reaction from Iran, and Bahrain becomes a battleground between Saudi and Iran, and this may prolong the conflict rather than put an end to it and make it an international event rather than a local uprising. That sounds like a really kicking the hornet's nest, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. Indeed, Bahrain is a very sensitive area to the United States Fifth Fleet, to Saudi Arabia, and to Iran. And now what seems to be happening is that an intervention that some people expected to occur some months ago, and especially the idea that Saudi Arabia will occupy Bahrain militarily, was around at least for the last couple of weeks, and it materialized. And that's sort of understandable, because Saudi Arabia is very worried about its own Shiite contingency in Ratif, in northeastern part especially, where the oil fields are. And they want to stop the spread of Shiite movement. And that's understandable why they intervene in Bahrain. But most often, wars and conflicts and interventions are easy to start, but the consequences are unpredictable. And I'm afraid that consequences of this intervention would be dire for the region.
Well, Rasul Nafisi, I spoke recently with a journalist with the only independent newspaper in Bahrain, And she was saying that the ruling family were, to her mind, being counterintuitive and counterproductive in using state media to stir up sectarian divisions between the Sunni minority and the Shia majority. And she is a Sunni, but recognizes that the Shia have legitimate complaints and that the royal family should be addressing these complaints, not cracking down. And she felt the Saudis were forcing their hand as well. So, you know, recently the Secretary of Defense Gates told the King of Bahrain that it's not a good idea to have these baby steps, he called them, in terms of reform. You really got to reform, otherwise you're going to lose control of this situation, as was witnessed in recently in Egypt. What is wrong with these people, these royals? Are they so reactionary that they can't see the writing on the wall?
I put myself in the shoes of the Sultan of Bahrain, and they are in a precarious situation. They have been ruling the island for, you know, almost two centuries, and now they are facing with a situation where Iran is increasing power. The local Shiite majority become aggressive. The United States is there and is demanding some kind of reform. But where do you start the reform? Because in reality, if they allow a authentic democracy or some sort of democracy emerge, Shiites will win. If they don't, they will end up in the situation that they are in right now. So it is not, it's not easy to say where the reform should start. Because by any meaningful reform, the Sunni minority will go down. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the situation of the Shiites, they seem to be having very legitimate claims. They have been not treated justly. On the other hand, when I look at the statement by their leaders, like Sheikh Isa Hassan or others, there is a inherently radical demand for a so-called democracy, meaning the rule of the Shiites. And concomitant with that is a call for Sharia law. And those are pretty scary thoughts or words, especially considering the fact that the very influential Sheikh Isa Qasim is also a proponent of the type of regime that exists in Iran. And so all of these combined, when the U.S. authorities asked for reforms, I'm not sure as where the reforms are supposed to start.
Well, let's begin with whether or not, for example, the Shia in Bahrain, they're Arabs, they're not Iranians, right?
Well, Shiite in Bahrain actually composed of three different ethnicities, Iraqi ethnicity, Persian ethnicity, and indigenous. And 10-15% actually speak Farsi. And but their loyalty, it seems to be more towards Iran, especially because there is such a deep and long conflict with the Sunni majority, Sunni minority. And what they are, especially the eyewitnesses told me, that now in villages near Manama, that there are pictures of the leaders of Iran and leaders of Lebanese Hezbollah are hanging from the walls, large posters. And that sort of tells me that it is not exactly like what is reflected in for example, the WikiLeaks documents. In WikiLeaks documents, we read that the assessment is Iranians are not involved. But whether or not it's a spiritual influence or real influence, I'm not sure. But certainly there's a tremendous influence, especially if you look at the point of view of the most influential of the clerics, meaning Sheikh Isa Qasim, they are pro-Iranian. So I imagine in a very situation, in very possible situation, either that's a revolutionary or reform, Iran will have a lot more influence in Bahrain than it has today.
Well, there, Rasul Nafisi, wouldn't it also follow that if the Saudis, and they do they not have a problem with their indigenous Shia in the oil-producing region? Isn't there a certain amount of discrimination, not the least of which is religious?
Yeah, of course they do. I mean, some hundreds of thousands of Shiites, especially in the Qatif area, and they are pretty much discriminated. Actually, they are discriminated against much more than they are in Bahrain, because Bahrain is not pushing their religion, meaning Sunni religion, on Shiites, but Wahhabi Saudis are pushing the religion on Shiites and opening Sunni schools in their area, as they are opening Sunni schools, meaning madrasas, Wahhabi madrasas, in Bahrain as well. And so you're absolutely right. There's more oppression in Saudi Arabia and resistance too in Saudi Arabia. But the point I'm raising is, if you look at the whole geopolitics of the Persian Gulf, and if you look at the players, what I'm trying to say is, when the United States is asking for reform, I wonder where the reform should start, to not allow more influence to Iranians or their proxies or their allies. That's the point I'm raising.
Sure, but I suspect what Gates had in mind was a little more inclusion and a little less repression. I mean, let's not go back to the 7th century and argue about the Shia being heretics.
Well, of course. The trouble is now, after a few people were killed and after the international community is paying attention to what's going on in Bahrain, the Shia majority is now interested in negotiations, and they're asking for full-scale reform and removal of the Al-Khalifa family. Well, that's a problem. Now, it could have, I mean, reforms could have started maybe some time ago, but right now, reforms would be revolutionary in consequence. In other words, the first steps towards any type of meaningful reform would end up in a larger scale upheaval in Bahrain, and that's something that would not benefit very many people in that area.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi. Well, it would seem, though, that if the heavy hand comes down and there's more repression and riots, etc., already Iran has condemned the intervention of Saudi Arabia. This would seem to be playing right into the hands of the Revolutionary Guard Corps regime of Ahmadinejad, who's got his own problems at home with the restive green movement. This is perfect for him, isn't it? This is a way to get everybody to unite around his unpopular regime, because the hated Saudis are beating up their co-religionists.
Absolutely. The Iranian regime has been sitting and watching the upheaval in the Muslim world, and then sort of bragging that they are not going through the same, although they are. Now, the important thing is for them to make a Bahraini situation issue, of course, would help the domestic issues as well, meaning they can claim that, you know, Saudi Arabia is doing such and such to their co-religionists, it's time to get involved and so forth. And in reality, overall, the Iranian regime thrives on chaos, and they enjoy chaos, no matter where it is, except in their own land. So basically, I imagine by creating chaos in Bahrain or the ongoing problem there, they would really be happy to see the situation prolonged. So I'm afraid that, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but some sort of Lebanese scenario, Lebanese-type scenario, may usher in that part of the Muslim world too. And that would be the most disastrous for many people, especially for the United States Fifth Fleet and the military school they have in Bahrain, and 5,000 people were stationed there. So I think that we are facing with a very precarious situation, and I'm not sure that the United States leadership is quite leading or they know exactly what's happening there.
But is there ever any evidence yet, Rasul Navisi, of a Hezbollah-type organization in Bahrain? Obviously, Hezbollah is a successful foreign policy surrogate of the Iranian regime, and they've had considerable success in Lebanon, where they now are pretty much in control.
I am told that in his return from London, the leader of the Shiites of Bahrain stopped over in Lebanon for 4 days. This is the only thing that I have heard, and I have not read, actually. So if that is true, it seems to be that he went there for some advice and instruction. Now, in terms of physical evidence, as I said, and is also reflected in WikiLeaks documents, it seems to be nothing tangible that you can put your hands on. But there's every circumstantial evidence that Iran is very influential in the region. Also, I heard that large cache of weapons was found lately in Bahrain. Again, this is something that I heard from people related to the Bahraini embassy in Washington.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Rasul Navisi.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Rasul Navisi, who is an academic and Middle East expert. His latest book is The Rise of Pasdaran, a monograph on the social, political, and economic roles of the guardians of the revolution in Iran. And he will soon publish another book called The Cultures of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with further discussion on rising tensions in the Gulf. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. He was also a senior fellow for Middle East Affairs at the Council on Foreign Relations. In 2003, he formed the consulting company Strategic Energy Information Group in Dubai. And your neighborhood there in the Gulf, Yusuf, is getting very tense today after the entrance of Saudi troops yesterday. Iran has lashed out at Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and of course there's been a substantial demonstration at the Saudi embassy where people were peacefully protesting and putting flowers in the gates. But clearly the Bahrainis are not happy with the arrival of the Saudis. Do you think this has the potential for escalating into some kind of broader surrogate confrontation or conflict between Saudi and Iran?
Yes, most definitely. But it's important to clarify that those Bahrainis who are very unhappy with the Saudi invasion, for lack of a better description, are the Shiite Bahrainis, who represent 70% of the population in that country, which is nevertheless ruled by a Sunni minority, a tribe that basically invaded the place 200 years ago.
And these are not Iranians. They're Arab Shiites. So I don't understand why Saudi Arabia and the king of Bahrain are engaging in sectarian divisions. I spoke with a reporter for the only independent newspaper in Bahrain recently, and she said that there's no question that it, to her mind, that the regime is exacerbating tensions between the Sunni minority and the Shia majority, and they're spreading all kinds of anti-Shia hate on state television.
Yes, but that is not true. That is not new. It's been true for as long as the Bahraini tribe, which has declared itself a kingdom, took over the island. Basically, it originates, the current ruler, who has become a king, originates from the same branches and structure of the leading and ruling tribes of Saudi Arabia, which of course are supremely led by the Al Saud family, hence the name Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, as it stands, is the harder nut of the hard nuts of Islamic fundamentalist thinking and theology in the Muslim world, say, as opposed to the more secular version of Islam, Sunni Islam in places like Egypt and Indonesia. But it is definitely an arch enemy of the other branch of Islam, which is Shia Islam. And its grand religious theological leaders and schools of thinking, which are closely allied with the royal family since the establishment of Saudi Arabia, take it as an article of faith. The Shiites are, in fact, infidels, on a notch below, actually, Christians and Jews, which they refer to, whom they refer to as sons of pigs and monkeys.
So are they prepared then, since they have the Saudis have a huge Shiite majority in the very area where the oil fields are, and if they are the tail that wags the dog in terms of the Bahraini royal family, and I understand the massacre that took place some time back in Pearl Square was either initiated by Saudi special forces or the king was pressured into it. So the Saudis are taking a hard line whether this king wants to follow Secretary of Defense Robert Gates's advice that these small steps towards reform aren't going to make it. So
yeah, he called them baby steps.
Baby steps, right?
But the fact of the matter, Ian, and the bigger picture is, we, the United States of America, have actually made a choice, and we made it very, very clearly, to stand by those regimes which are in the process of being challenged by their people. You remember, Ian, very clearly that the President Obama and the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, only days before Hosni Mubarak was forced to leave Egypt, referred to him as a stable a ruler and a friend of the United States, and Egypt is a stable regime. As a matter of fact, the envoy of Obama, Ambassador Frank Wisner, who went to see Mubarak, came out of that meeting saying, you know, he thinks Mubarak ought to finish his current term, which ended 2013. In the same time, we clearly stand by Saudi Arabia, and we clearly stand by the King of Bahrain. Now, when we started rethinking this barely a day or two before the popular revolution triumphed in Tunisia and the popular revolution triumphed in Egypt, we began to change our tune, saying, you know, we believe in democracy and the rule of the people and reforms. We've been saying the same thing about Saudi Arabia for 20 years, but we don't really insist on it. So basically, we make our choices depending on our strategic interest. And our strategic interest really hasn't been with the little people of Tunisia or the little people of Egypt. And at this point, we don't really have a new policy on how to deal with the Egyptian revolution and the Tunisian revolution. And we most certainly do not have a policy on how to deal with the Libyan revolution. And you would think on this one, our position ought to be crystal clear. I mean, Muammar Gaddafi is going to have a very hard time to find a single person who actually receives him in their country after this. And yet, we haven't had a position on this. So basically, our position seems to be motivated by stability related to oil supplies.
Well, but isn't it reached a point now where you're talking in general about our foreign policy tradition of realpolitik, Yusuf Ibrahim, and it would seem that we're reaching an era now where acting according to our ideals may end up being more pragmatic than acting in our so-called interests. And I'm just astounded that, and if Gates tried to advise this king to get with reform in a real way, and I imagine if we dare advise the Saudis to do the same thing, they don't listen to us. But frankly, it would seem that unless the Saudi royals start treating their own people a little better, and particularly the minority people, the Shiites, who now apparently they're going to inflame, they're going to go down in flames.
Not only their Shiites, I mean, they have a lot of young people among their majority, crushing majority Sunni population, who have long ago broken from this royal family, which is basically, the youngest person in line for the throne is 80 years old. The current king is, I think, 84, and he is extremely ill. He probably will be gone in a year or so. The crown prince, Sultan, has been in and out of hospitals for 9 months. He spent several months here, and indeed King Abdullah himself booked the entire floor of the New York Presbyterian Hospital for a whole month. So basically, this is a very old generation of the Saudi royal family. It does have a new generation, but the new generation, the youngest among those, is like 65. Is probably the current foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal. So there isn't really a young generation in there, and when you really get to the young generation that needs to be empowered, they are very unhappy with this very aging, paralyzed old regime. I mean, it's not only about letting women drive cars, it's about letting women exist to begin with. It's a truly medieval regime with no alternative vision. Now, that's juxtaposed with a very young population that has become extremely wealthy over the years of oil production since the 70s. It's on the internet. It's connected to the world. It's gone to UCLA and Berkeley and Columbia and Harvard and so on and so forth. And just comes back home to find it cannot relate to that country at all. Now, that's only in Saudi Arabia. The other thing that has happened to Saudi Arabia, which is important to consider when we look at the situation, is it has suddenly found itself frighteningly alone. Its biggest friend in the region, its other axis of power partner, Egypt, has had a revolution. And as you have read today and probably yesterday and in the past few days, the Saudi king was calling Barack Obama almost every day saying, you've got to allow the Egyptian police to shoot and kill those people and stop telling them not to do that because they cannot take power. And in fact, the Saudi king has canceled Hillary Clinton's visit to Saudi Arabia, which came out today in the newspaper, because he feels slighted by the refusal of the United States to abide by his decision. In fact, we did not really support the Egyptian revolution, but we couldn't go so far as to tell the Egyptian police, go ahead and kill your people. And besides, the issue was not in our hand. We basically were out of the picture.
But
that's the kind of mentality you're dealing with. You're dealing with a regime that considers merely the only form of dialogue in Saudi Arabia is to present petitions. You present a petition to the local prince. You present a petition to the governor. Basically, Saudi Arabian royal family has reduced its people to beggars who are given their rights as a favor.
So if this is the mentality of the king in terms of his advice to Barack Obama vis-a-vis Mubarak shooting his own people, presumably the king in Saudi Arabia and the royal family would shoot their people at the drop of a hat.
Well, what's more important, Ian, now is, are they going to shoot Bahraini people?
Well, I think, though, if we broaden this out a little, Yusuf Ibrahim, isn't this playing into the Iranian regime, which is not particularly popular at home? But if the Saudis and the Bahrainis resort to this kind of sectarian wedge tactic and start brutalizing or killing the Shiite majority in Bahrain, won't the Iranian regime be able to use this as a rallying call to get some more legitimacy at home by saying, you know, we've got to stand up for our co-religionous brothers?
You're absolutely right, but I like to give you, to widen the scenario in a dramatic fashion, and I'm going to make you bet that this is exactly what's going to happen in the next few weeks. There is a large party of people inside the ruling regime in Iran who are today celebrating. They are the happiest people on the face of the earth. They have gotten exactly what they want, which is Saudi forces coming into Bahrain, which is basically their oyster. They have a huge amount of influence inside Bahrain. They have the natural affinity of their Shiite brethren there, only by virtue of the faith. And they have a natural sympathy, of course, for people in of their religious faith who are being persecuted because of their religious faith by Saudis, of all people. But what's more important, they have a Saudi army that is probably the most hapless, inefficient, unable to fight, never fought before army in the Arab world. And they are waiting for them to really start playing with them. And this is exactly what the Saudis have presented them with now. You will see, as you saw in Iraq, where the Iranians were able to form a gigantic network of Shiite cells and underground fighters, which harassed the United States Army very seriously. In fact, half of our casualties in Iraq were caused by Iranian-trained Shiite fighters.
Well, thanks to George W. Bush, the Iranians have effectively ended up with Iraq.
Exactly. And in fact, so that's the picture you're looking at, Ian. You're looking at Iraq, which is a majority Shiite-ruled country, naturally sympathizing with those Shiites inside Saudi Arabia and certainly sympathizing with the Shiites in Bahrain. And of course, the Iraqis are really angry because the Iranians for years now have been sending Sunni fighters inside Iraq to kill Shiites. So there is a revenge element waiting here to happen. There is Hezbollah in Lebanon, which of course is Shiite and not at all sympathetic to the Saudis, and in fact has defeated the Saudis supported. So basically, you have what the Saudis did is put a fire to a sectarian divide that didn't really need any more gasoline poured over it.
Again, speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who was the New York Times senior regional Middle East correspondent for 18 years and has spent a number of the last years in the Gulf. The Saudi regime have to feel also, not only are they alone because they lost their biggest supporter in the neighborhood, Hosni Mubarak, they also, the government they backed in Lebanon just fell to Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy. So do you think that Bahrain could become another Beirut?
I think this is where we're heading. Of course, it's much more serious, Beirut, because Beirut, people can continue to kill each other, but the vital interest of the United States and the vital interest of what we call the West, i.e. oil and economy, is not directly involved.
And the Fifth
However,
Fleet. And
in
the
that region, it is.
But I'm saying that you're alluding to the Fifth Fleet, right?
And the Fifth Fleet is there, of course, but the example we have given in Libya is that we can have an entire armada and the order we're giving it is to do nothing. So I suspect, looking at President Obama's current policy, that he will not want to. What he will simply do is order the Fifth Fleet to leave instead of to engage. However, we are supporting the King of Bahrain. How we're supporting him is not very clear.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think that given that Gates at least tried to give the king what seems like sensible advice, and I don't know that the Saudis would take our advice, so is there any possibility of them being a little more enlightened, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, and giving some baby steps or more than baby steps towards some kind of constitutional monarchy before they end up being driven out of town?
Yeah, and I think we're long past that point, not only in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, in the entire Middle East. In effect, when you think of it, and I'm sure you'll agree with that, the Egyptian revolution, which is, what, 3 weeks old already, 4 weeks old, is only beginning. They're already now beginning in the second phase, which hauling Mubarak into trials and arresting a thousand people, at least supreme businessmen, allies of Mubarak and his kids, are being arrested. This is only the second phase of the Egyptian revolution, and it's only beginning now. What we are looking at in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia is not the beginning of phase one, is the introduction to phase one. I think we are going to have, I mean, for us as journalists, this is in many ways very exciting. For the people of the region, it is the moment of truth.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You can leave comments, and I'd love to hear from you. I'll be back again tomorrow for another Background Briefing. Bye for now.